Committee on Employee Relations of the Legislative Coordinating Commission will come to order. It is September 29th, 2004, and members have received a packet. You know, we originally scheduled the day to have the working group, which is actually the subcommittee, the entire subcommittee, plus a number of people from other organizations having an interest in the salary cap. That meeting is scheduled for 10 o'clock, but because we have two contracts that are ready for approval, we decided to have this meeting a half hour before that. So sorry we're late. We're hoping that another representative will be able to join us here. So I think we'll just get going, and members receive the summary. I think you probably receive a hard copy of that in the mail before the meeting, and of course we all have it in our packet on the two agreements that are they're ready for our review. The first is the Interfaculty Organization, the IFO, collective bargaining agreement, and I think Mr. Shida is going to go through that for us. Welcome. Good morning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning. My name is Bill Cheeta. I'm the Vice Chancellor for Human Resources with the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities System. I have with me today Chris Dale, who was the Chief Negotiator for the system on the Interfaculty Organization contract. Madam Chair, what I thought that I would do is just touch briefly on some of the highlights of the agreement, and then we would be available to answer any questions you or the committee might have.
That's fine. That's good.
this was a protracted and difficult negotiations. We reached tentative agreement with the Interfaculty Organization on July 1st, and the terms of the agreement, some of the highlights are that there is no across-the-board increase in either year of the contract. All eligible faculty will receive a step increase in the second year of the contract, July 1st, 2004. And employees at the top of the salary ranges will receive a lump sum payment of $2,400. A number of economic provisions were continued unchanged. Those are things like promotions, career steps, and supplemental retirement contributions. We also continued the early notification payment, but we added new language that if a faculty member was at the top of the salary range, they would receive a lump sum payment for that early notification. We created an employer contribution to the faculty member's medical dental expense account of $500, and in the second year of the biennium, there's an additional one-time $100 payment to that account. Per credit payment for adjunct and community faculty was increased by $25, and we adjusted the minimum step placement for faculty in the instructor, assistant professor, associate professor, and professor lanes. I think a major accomplishment was the implementation of the state employee group insurance program as provided in other collective bargaining agreements in the state. We reduced the employer contribution for dependent coverage from 100% to 85%. Contracts for other bargaining units previously provided 90% coverage for dependents, which was reduced to 85%. We also provided a prorated employer contribution for part-time employees. Again, this brought our collective bargaining agreement in line with other collective bargaining agreements for state employees in this regard. Excuse me. We increased the tuition waiver for faculty from the current level of 27 credits per year to 30 credits per year. We continued the phased retirement program, the sabbatical leave program, and the early retirement incentive program for faculty who were hired prior to 1996. The cost of the agreement in this biennium is 1.84%, and the increase in biennial costs from this biennium to the next is 4.14%. Madam Chair, those are the highlights of the agreement, and would be happy to answer any questions the committee might have.
Members of the committee have any questions? Yes, Representative De La Forest.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Cheetah, good morning. Maybe a question for Mr. Dale. I know the insurance provisions were the subject of litigation at one point. What's the procedural posture of that litigation? What happened with it?
Good morning, Chair Scheid, Representative De La Forest. The procedural posture of the litigation is that the case has been dismissed and the temporary injunction that was issued was dissolved by the court.
Thank you.
Other questions, members?
Madam Chair, just a question.
Representative Haas.
When would we officially ratify these? After we go back into session in January?
Representative Haas, yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, when you would say we, you mean the legislature. Yeah, the subcommittee can act today. We,
right.
Another member, but there would be a recommendation to the legislature.
Okay.
But it's important that we do this. Again, Mr. Hubinger, if you would.
And Madam Chair and members, if the subcommittee approves the contracts today, they can go into effect. If the subcommittee chooses not to do that, they won't go into effect until a bill is passed or until the subcommittee meets within 30 days since the contracts have been officially submitted to us now.
Okay. Mr. Cheetah, Mr. Dale, thank you very much.
Madam Chair.
I think we will ask Mr. Larson. To present us the, or go over the collective bargaining agreement for the LEA, the Minnesota Law Enforcement Association. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Morning.
Morning, Madam Chair. My name is Paul Larson. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Employee Relations. To my right is Jill Pettis. Jill Pettis is the Compensation Manager. Department of Employee Relations. Any questions that you have of her or I, happy to answer your questions. I'll briefly give you a summary of the contract that is before you. This is the contract with the state's law enforcement unit, represented by the Minnesota Law Enforcement Association. They are the non-supervisory sworn police officers that are prized at the Department of Natural Resources, the Department of Public Safety, Department of Corrections. These are special agents from the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, conservation officers, and state patrol troopers, as well as fugitive specialists. There are approximately 700 employees assigned to this bargaining unit. This unit is an essential unit. It elected to go to interest arbitration. The parties went to interest arbitration last spring. The results of the arbitrator's decision were rendered in late May. We provided you with the arbitrator's decision for you to review in, I believe, June 14th. The central issue that was at dispute in that arbitration hearing was whether or not there would be an across-the-board increase in both years of the contract. The arbitrator sustained the employer's position, and as a result of that, this contract reflects basically the same overall settlement patterns that the employer was seeking at the bargaining table. It provides for annual step increases for the employees in this unit. There are approximately 40% of the employees that are eligible for step movement during the 2 years of the contract. The average step size is approximately 4%. There are no, as I said, no across-the-board increases. We continued with the clothing allowance at $450 a month. We continued to provide a deferred compensation match of $350 a month. We continued to provide for the severance pay to go into a health care savings account. And in addition to that, we also agreed in bargaining that the employee's vacation payout at the time of retirement would also go into the health care savings account. The insurance program is consistent with the other state employee groups. They are participating in the state employee group insurance program, and the employer contribution remains the same, consistent with the other units as well. The overall biennial costs for this contract increased by 1.10%, and the biennial base increase for the next biennium is 3.69%. Total new money in this contract is approximately $1.8 million.
Mr. Larson, what we have written in front of us says that clothing allowance is a per-year figure. I think that's what...
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Okay. And I thought I heard you say per month, but I...
Oh, did I? I stand corrected. I'm sorry.
It's all right. Sorry. But it sounded pretty good. Any questions from members? I guess not. Okay, thank you very much. And
Madam Chair,
yes, Representative.
We still have two contracts out.
I believe that's correct. I believe we have the engineers and nurses. Yes, do you want to speak? Mr. Larson? Just good to comment on the fact it looks like we have two units that haven't, for which we don't have agreement yet. Nurses and.
We do have two contracts that are still out there. Okay, we have one contract, the Minnesota Nurses Association, which elected to go to interest arbitration. They rejected the state's offer, and we have just concluded that arbitration hearing yesterday.
Okay.
So as a result of that, the briefs are due in 30 days. At which point the arbitrator has 30 days to render their decision. So that's the timetable that we're under. The other contract that we have is with the Minnesota Government Engineers Council. We also gave them our offer, and they have rejected our offer. There has been no discussions yet as to whether or not they will be going to interest arbitration.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Other questions or comments? No. Thanks very much for coming on. I'm not really at a loss, but we just sort of...
Perhaps we can proceed to the discussion of the working group, and if another member comes, we can go back and take action on the two contracts.
But I think that, members, that's what we're going to have to do, and I hope that you can stay for... we're waiting for Representative Paymar, I believe, and we think he's coming, so...
Madam Chair, I'd point out to the members that the two contracts that we've heard have formally been submitted to the subcommittee today, and under the law, if the subcommittee does not reject them within 30 days, they will go into effect today.
So that's helpful. Thank you. I keep having to have my mind refreshed about if we do or if we don't.
Mr. Shepherd reminded me.
So I think we will do that. And we will, I guess, I don't know if we would call it a recess, the subcommittee, and then call upon, and I don't foresee any difficulties with approval of the resolution. I don't know if members have any issues they want to raise at this time. This is the time to do it with the two agreements that we've just heard. So I think we will recess the subcommittee, and then we will move on to the working group, which means that those people in the room who are here for that are certainly welcome to join us at the table. In fact, we want you to join us at the table. Good. Good morning, Commissioner. Mr. Mayor.
Hello. Good morning.
In your folder, you will find the agenda for the working group. And I think that one of the things we will do is reintroduce ourselves. If we can, for members who may not have been here at the first meeting. And Commissioner, I don't think you were.
I was not.
You were not at the table then that day either. Yeah. It helps if you sort of face that toward me. There. That's good. And I think I'll start with the commissioner and introduce him to you. Cal Ludeman, Commissioner of the Department of Employee Relations. I don't know, Commissioner, did you want to say anything?
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Oh, that's good.
You're asking for more than that.
No, not yet. And we'll just go around that way. Pettis.
I'm Jill Pettis. I'm the Assistant State Negotiator and Compensation Manager for the state.
Bill Hargis. I'm Mayor of City of Woodbury.
Jim Burmeier with the Burmeier Group Executive Search.
Tom Goodwin with the Apple Valley City Council.
Ardell Brady, Mayor of Rochester.
I was announcing.
I think
thank
that's
you.
It. Yes.
Sandy Pappas, State Senator from St. Paul.
David Gaither, State Senator, Plymouth.
And I'm Senator Scheid, from State Senator from Brooklyn Park, and representing Brooklyn Center as well.
I'm Bill Haas, and I represent Champlin and Western Park of Coon Rapids.
Chris DeLaForest, I represent Central Anoka County, the cities of Andover and Ham Lake.
And then I think that everybody knows Mr. Hubinger, Greg Hubinger, who is the Director of the Legislative Coordinating Commission, and Mark Shepard is the House Counsel, representing the House of Representatives here for us today. And Sandy, do you say your last name, Kuhn? Kuhn?
Keen.
Is the Administrative Assistant to Mr. Hubinger, for Mr. Hubinger in the department. So, we're just introducing ourselves here.
Good morning.
Hello.
Tom Hedges, the City Administrator for EGAN, representing the State City and County Managers Association.
Thank you for being here. Thank you all for being here.
Oh, no, that's fine.
And, Commissioner, I don't know if you want to talk from there or from up at the desk. I think it's fine here if we sit at the table, if that's all right with you.
It feels good to
okay.
me.
Okay, and we've got you first on the agenda here. Right. Do you have a copy of the agenda? And
I do.
Okay. And if you'd kind of give your perspective on the value of the cap.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and the members of the committee and the members of the study group. I do know that it's easy for us to recognize that the 95% cap that currently exists in law has probably in its early introduction didn't create a lot of frustration. It seems to have created more frustration as time went on, obviously, with the at least during the time of general wage inflation during the late 90s, at least there were some pressures coming to bear on the existence of that cap, especially when the salary of the governor was not being increased or proposed to be increased. However, since I suppose in perspective, since 9/11, some changes in the general economy, that what we have found at the Department of Employee Relations, at least as it relates to the function or the administration of the current law, and I think we're going to talk more generally about the existence of the law in just a few moments. But the administration of the law has not, at least from our evidence, created a significant degree of recruitment or retention problems for local units of government. There were some salary cap waivers that were granted very early in 2003. Since then, there has been very, very, very few of them. In fact, only one. Whether it's administered, we believe that this law is administered well with all due diligence and process with our compensation unit at the Department of Employee Relations. We think that we have looked carefully at the issues of recruitment and retention as it both relates to any incumbent in the current position or the ability of local units of government to recruit administrators of local units of government. I think, though, a lot of that avoids the issue about whether the cap itself, the 95% cap law, is a good idea or not. I think members of this committee have been given some history or some information about how it has evolved over time. Its genesis way back to the time when I was in the legislature, which was quite some time ago, but it was also repealed at one time during my tenure, but it has come back. It is the law, and it is our responsibility to administer that law as professionally as we possibly can. If the issue is whether state government should have this direct relationship with local units of government, it may avoid the question whether local units of government have complete autonomy on all issues related to their governance. You, as legislators, understand that there is a relationship between state government and local units of government, certainly as it relates to school aid formulas, local government aid formulas. There is a intricate relationship between the delivery of services and the all things that go on. You hear about, as a state legislator, you hear about issues related to counties, cities, school districts, and state government. So the legislature spoke on that issue, and they put in a 95% salary cap with the ability to grant waivers from the Department of Employee Relations. We still believe that in this year of 2004, there is still not exaggerated problem with retention or recruitment. We think that in some ways, we do actually hear it from some local officials that this does take some of the pressure off of them. I don't think that's a view of paternalism that I would necessarily enjoy, and so I don't promote that as a reason for the existence of the law. But obviously the posture of us is at the Department of Employee Relations in our role to negotiate state contracts with 48,000, or at least with 32,000 state employees, and for partial contracts for another 16,000 state employees, and seeing that the trend or the pattern that Deputy Commissioner Larson spoke to just a little earlier, this may not be a very good time to too aggressively about the repeal of the law, and I think this administration doesn't support that. Their legislators think law should be repealed and go back to the more philosophical relationship between the state and local units of government is the decision of the legislature. But it's kind of a tough position to have zero across the board increases granted to this many state employees and at the same time be too aggressive inviting waiver applications from the local units of government. We don't invite them, we don't reject them, we accept them, we look at them, and we render decisions. So that is our position, that we don't believe that the law should be repealed. Yeah. If it should be repealed, it shouldn't be repealed now. So we think the current economy speaks to this kind of compensation discipline, and we think it has been actually supportive of our efforts in negotiating with a lot of employees in relatively tough budget and economic times. Madam Chairman, that's sort of an overview of our view of the 95%.
Do you, in looking at it, as a former legislator and also in your position as commissioner, do you think it was a reasonable measure to take even by the legislature? I mean, you're free to say the legislature. we know that sometimes we do some things. I think it was, if I'm not mistaken, I think we're the only state in the country that does this. And I don't really know whose idea this was to begin with. Can you talk about maybe, do you think it's created some strange disparities, I think. I mean, the legislature realized the issues with health care, with medicine and hospitals, and with the education system. Well, but there are some interesting disparities where there's wide variations among like entities, and then that concerns me, and the fact that we keep getting requests for waivers. So if you could...
Madam Chairman and members of the committee, obviously one of the problems with the law is that there's a lot of people not under this cap. So there has been the hospital administrators, medical profession, school administrators. These are people that we're not talking about in the application of this law. So basically we're talking about local units of government, counties and cities, that feel the effect of this law. If I may speak as a former legislator, relations. I don't even remember how I voted on any of these issues, but I.
We can find out real quick.
I probably would have thought at that time that there needed to be some autonomy or some sense of local control or discretion on the part of local government. As it got specifically to this issue, in other words, compensation for its top administrators, it probably, as you know, as legislators, it was probably an issue that was presented by some anecdotal evidence that something had happened that seemed unreasonable, as with much legislation. So if a local units of government had granted or recruited for a salary that seemed out of bounds, out of the realm of what many of the public would have considered sensible, probably resulted in people wanting to do something about that in the legislature and may have acted. I can't remember that well, Chair, even though we served together at the same time. I probably would have thought that was an issue of local control. But now as a commissioner, we have to administer a law that currently exists. I have to look at the sense of timing, the sense of where we sit, and also my job responsibilities other than the administration of this law. And so it is puts us in a strange place. Should the department, maybe one of the questions should be whether the Department of Employee Relations should have this sort of a relationship, which we have few of. We have pay equity administration, and we have the 95% salary cap application. Everything else we do has to do with the executive branch of state government. And so this is really our only relationship with local units of government that we have at the Department of Employee Relations. But we think consistency is a big part of our unified message when we go into salary negotiations, for example, with state employees. And so it wouldn't be up to the Department of Employee Relations to say we should repeal the law or grant waivers automatically or raise the cap of the law. That answers exactly the question you asked.
No, I wondered if you could maybe share with us of the waivers that have come before you or have been requested of the department since you're in your tenure here. How many, can you give us some numbers on that? How many?
Not sure exactly the number. I guess we certainly have that. And I think generally speaking, I think for the committee's perspective, I don't think we have any current applications now. That's correct. Now, that obviously is folks probably have paid some attention and are making a judgment about whether they would have a chance of success or not. And yet of the ones that, and I know that Washington County, Ramsey County, I'm trying to think of a few of the most recent ones, we still believe, and you'll see in the responses to those applications for the waiver, that we did not believe that there was a current or pending recruitment or retention issues related to them. The one that some folks have spoken about is the Minneapolis police chief position, which a waiver was granted. We thought that there was some exceptional recruitment issues related to that. That there was going to be a national search for a police chief of Minneapolis with a visibility and a timing of an occupation that was extremely important, evolving with Homeland Security and lots of other issues related to that. Interestingly enough, though, and I think we can speak forthrightly about that the city of St. Paul did recruit, actually internally, for their police chief, and no waiver application came to this department, I believe.
That is correct.
And so a lot of recruitment, obviously a lot of retention is going on without applications for waivers of this salary cap law. Do you have the actual number since?
When did you come?
About middle of January.
Three.
In just a second, we'll give you the number of applications. That probably would be useful to the committee.
Yeah. Any questions? Yes, Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, you seem to allude to some effect on labor negotiations of the salary cap. Do you, the department, have some evidence that that's actually true? For example, let's compare ourselves with Wisconsin. Are Wisconsin local government employees compensated at a greater level than Minnesota local government employees, to your knowledge?
Local government employees?
If this effect that you were alluding to had in terms of labor negotiations from uncapping employees has an effect on, is there some evidence? I'm just putting out for an example. Our Wisconsin local government employees, our closest neighbor, probably most analogous to us, compensated more than our local government employees?
I don't know if we have averages, obviously, Madam Chairman. I think, Mr. Carlson, it would vary absolutely across the board from local units of government in any part of Wisconsin to any part of Minnesota, but I don't know if we have that. We don't do a lot of compensation work with local units of government, obviously, but we do watch settlements as they come in from cities, counties, and school districts. We watch patterns. Related to that, but obviously most of that data is Minnesota-related, not Wisconsin. The dynamic, I think, is what we're talking about. The repeal of the cap, for example, what effect would that be? I do know, as it affects our ability to negotiate contracts, that union officials do talk to me about this issue. As a citizen, probably in their position, but they are interested in watching the actions of this department relative to what we're positions we're taking relative to negotiations with them. But I do know that there is a relationship to the action.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, then, there have been a number of times we have a similar sort of cap at the state level, and there have been a number of adjustments in the levels of compensation of the commissioners over the years. So are you suggesting that there's been an effect on your labor negotiations because of those adjustments?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Mr. Carlson, since I've been here, and I can speak to at least to that experience, that there have been no adjustments in the compensation of commissioner level or the current state cap for officials relative to the governor's salary. The IT exceptions, the medical exceptions have existed over time. There are many state employees paid more than the governor. This is a surprise to a lot of people. But since then, since January of 2003, for example, I can't speak to the effect on negotiations because no change has happened in administrative compensation that is any different than salary negotiations with rank and file employees.
Madam Chair?
Maybe I'm not catching the question.
Mr. Carlson?
I appreciate that none of those adjustments have occurred during the commissioners, but Ms. Pettis does have some history going back over that time period. Maybe she can tell us if there have been some effect on the negotiations when the commissioners' salary caps have been adjusted in the past.
Ms. Pettis, I don't know if that's quantifiable.
Madam Chair, Mr. Carlson, I don't know what the percentage increase was for the agency heads the last time. I believe it occurred in 2000. And honestly, I have been here in this position since 2001.
Okay. I appreciate it. Madam Chair, just maybe one other question. Commissioner, right now we have a system that really is not an apples-to-apples comparison, whereas the local government officials, basically every piece of their compensation, including car allowance, a possible housing allowance, is included on their side of the ledger. On the governor's side of the ledger, we do not include the value of his housing. We do not include the value of his car, his chauffeur through the state patrol. Is that an appropriate measure, then, in your opinion?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair and Mr. Carlson, I and members of the committee, it is our job to administer the law, and I think in 1993 the law did change at least the calculation for the local government official to make sure that all these other forms of compensation were included in the calculation of that cap. Now, whether the governor should be calculated in some different way is it's whether the governor. I mean, if you talk about salary alone, is $120,000 an adequate compensation as far as pay for the governor of the state of Minnesota, with 5 million people, a $30 billion general fund budget, all the responsibilities that I don't need to educate this committee about for the governor of the state, whoever it may be. It's in the middle range of all the states, so it's not highly compensated and it's not low. There's some actually bigger states with lower compensated governors. Should the other elements of compensation be included in it? I think a lot of it could say that this is a term and a condition of being the governor, that the responsibilities of the residents are beyond just living there, that the ability to for transportation is kind of a 24/7 obligation on the part of the governor to get to the places that he needs to get to or she needs to get to for the purposes of governing the state. Is that true of local government administrators? I think partially so, too. But apples to apples, I think it's a tough way to stretch a direct comparison to compensation of a governor and local government officials and or other state officials.
Thank you.
I appreciate your concern that it's a tough thing to compare.
Anybody else? Yes, Mr. Goodwin.
Commissioner, your comments earlier were to the effect that there's this link because the state, either now or in the past, has been to some extent involved in reimbursing local government for part of their aids. As we all know, the state took over the schools, basically, the funding of the schools. Some superintendents would argue that that's not true, but basically that's the way it is. Yet, here's the state giving all this money to schools, and yet what's the one local government where there's no cap? Schools. It's just a strange thing. Now, in Apple Valley, where I'm on the council, a couple years ago, not that many years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, we got a total of about $3 million a year between LGA and the old homestead credit. And now, of course, we have market value credit. We're totally out of the LGA business. And I think a lot of the metropolitan cities that are directly impacted by this cap are out of the LGA business. And last year, we got no market value homestead credit, and with the deficit that looks like the legislature is facing again, there's a real question as to whether or not we'll get it. And for us, I mean, there's a terrible irony for me as a city council member. We've been let go by the state. They've said, hey, we just don't have the money to help you folks anymore. You're on your own. Yet we're trying to control your salaries. And so the argument that there's a direct link between the fact that the state provides state aids and there should be some way the states look at least having a handle on the salaries, quite frankly, just doesn't hold anymore, at least with the cities. And the irony is, again, it's a metropolitan city, isn't some outstate cities, but mostly the metro cities are being hit by this, and these are the folks that are out of the LGA business and, for the most part, out of the market value homestead credit business. So to me, it's the example you used earlier of having a link between state aids and some salary control just, at least in the present environment, just doesn't hold up.
Yeah, I think the frustration, and I'm sure the commissioner feels it, is that he didn't write the law.
No, I understand. He was using it as an example. He was giving an example of a link between state aid and salary control.
Right.
I just wanted to clarify that.
Madam Chairman,
yes,
if I may, and Mr. Goodwin, I appreciate the irony. The fact that, in fact, a couple of the stories in these legislators before us have read the same stories I have, that perhaps the avoidance of the bad story, and that's not the only standard of which we should live our lives, but has been more related to school administrators than local government officials.
Yet and they're the ones that got away from the cap.
Speaking to legislators as well as you, that they need to appreciate that irony. Perhaps examination of school administrators is the other way to look at it.
I'm not suggesting you go there.
I understand.
Mr. Hargis.
Am I saying
your name right?
Hargis. Yeah, thank you. I had a question because I didn't think that you had to approve our, I mean, we're involved in union negotiations as well, but I'm not up on the details, but my understanding is that you don't actually approve our negotiations, our contracts that we negotiate.
No.
And the issues that you're concerned about, I mean, we have to do when we balance our budget. I mean, we have to be concerned with the compensation of the people that lead the city in the day-to-day operations. We need to be concerned with fairly compensating the people that do the actual work. So I think you mentioned local control, and I think we need to be clear that you don't need to approve our negotiations. It's one of the things that we need to balance, as well as our tax rate. We need, you know, these people that run the day-to-day operations, the leadership have been put under a tremendous amount of pressure, financial pressure, just due to the state of the economy in the state. And I don't, you know, in the short and the long term, particularly the long term, I'm concerned that we're going to, these people that with the management and the leadership skills, we're going to push them into other industries or other states because their skills are portable. But to give us an exception or grant the waivers, my understanding is there is no sense applying for a waiver because since 2003, nobody's been granted a waiver for the basically political reasons. But if we're really true to the local control and holding us accountable, I think from a fairness standpoint, we can balance the needs and demands of the administrators as well as the employees, as well as be accountable to our taxpayers. We're pretty clear about that, and I would hold up our financial management tools and explanations to you know, anybody, and I think that's appropriate. So I don't I share Mr. Goodman's frustrations about that. I think maybe the cap is well-intentioned, but it's pushing towards the opposite result of what's really actually happening, and you're going to get, in the long term, you don't know how much it costs to have this cap because it really retains incompetent people and it pushes the competent people into other fields of work or other states where they can get 50 to 100% more.
I was going to ask the commissioner if you have given any thought to things we might do to tinker if we're going to live with a salary cap, and it seems like we probably are, just politically. Have you given thought to anything, any kind of adjustments or any tinkering we might do? Mr. Carlson discussed the apples to apples or apples to oranges issues with the various things that are included in compensation with the governor versus local government people. But also, I'm guessing that an increase in the governor's salary just puts the problem, we'll catch up to that problem also, and it's probably also politically not likely to happen. Do you see any kind of other tinkering we might do that might help? Because I think there is some, I know there's pressure. Mr. Goodwin describes a situation for suburban communities, being part of the metropolitan area, being part of a being close to communities would have larger salaries, knowing that, as Mr. Hargis says, their skills are portable. I think there is a sense that I don't know how many administrators or other, you know, police chiefs, city managers have left. Maybe we'll learn some of that coming up here. But it seems to me those are real possibilities. Have you thought of something we might do to better live with the system?
Well, Madam Chairman, I guess I can only give some thoughts or to the degree that there may be some instruction, but not advocate. I will reiterate that I don't believe that we have any current issue of major retention or recruitment problems, and I think that's still an issue that the folks of this committee need to at least hear. At least that is our view, that there are not significant current recruitment or retention problems. But as it relates to a legislature that is going to deal with it, what we believe, I think, has been publicly reported, at least a $400 million structural imbalance, and perhaps even more. To talk about adjustments in this law probably would have to be something about what Mr. Carlson had referred to in sort of a calculation exercise. I would like, though, to say that if there is to be any action about that on the part of any legislative activity, it probably should be fairly transparent. I wouldn't like this to be done in such a way that the way local units of government deal with this is to find other ways to compensate than open and upfront and transparent to the people that they work for example, city councils and county commissions and the taxpayers that they represent. So wouldn't like to see a lot of cars being bought and homes being bought, parishes being bought. So, you know, that I don't think we would like to be, certainly I think you would as legislators like to be careful to make sure that this is an open and transparent compensation issue that's dealt with fairly. So perhaps just the way that we calculate, we would certainly certainly abide by the law and administer the law as it is written. And if it's about calculation of the governor's salary, for example,
okay,
is probably one way to look at it.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Hedges.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Mr. Commissioner, I've been a city administrator for 32 years in the state of Minnesota, St. Peter and Egan. And the thing that I've taken great pride in, and my colleagues have in this state, is being able to retain and attract the best and the brightest. And I think Minnesota has always had that characterization nationwide that it's a good place to go if you are the best and brightest. Minnesota's a destination. I don't know, I don't mean to take issue, but I'm not sure that retention and recruitment by the mere fact that there are people filling positions are addressing the best and the brightest. And what I mean by that, when I talk to my colleagues, the assistants are migrating out of Minnesota. They're seeking states where there are no salary caps. There are a lot more opportunities in terms of wages and benefits and those sorts of things. I think you find Minnesota with a group of people like myself that are baby boomers that have established ourselves for 30-some years, and we're a year or two away from Rule of 90, and it's difficult to just uproot and go somewhere else to pursue public service, which has been what I'm all about. I'm not on this committee for myself. I will never testify the poor me and PRA and all those sorts of things. I'm here for the future of this profession and what this salary cap is doing to the profession. I would state that if you talk to Hamlin, to the dean of Hamlin University, or to Mankato State Urban Studies, The young people know about this. They're migrating to the non-for-profits. They're seeking other directions if they don't aspire to be the city administrator of Eagan, Minnesota anymore. There's compression issues. There's what's the use issues. There's all sorts of things that are existing. I don't mean to paint a glim picture, but it's out there. And will we fill positions? Will we recruit? Absolutely. I would state that in the private sector, if you put a salary cap on our city budget is $40 million a year. I think in a local corporation in this metropolitan area, you could find somebody to run that local company of $40 million at $114,000. I'm not sure it is the best and brightest in who you would want running it. My concern is that the fabric that we have created a wonderful local government structure in this state is going to there's a creep setting in that's just going to position us a lot differently in the future. And I'm real concerned about that, and I just want to share that. Maybe it's more of a statement than it is a question for you, but I think this recruitment retention is something that we need to really look at deeply. But the waiver issue, if I may, and then I'll be quiet here, but on the waiver issue, I think most of us really are subscribing to what's the use. Our energies are to running our local governments and doing them well, not making an issue out of that. And I will say this, we've had faith, and we still maintain faith. Maybe it's a glimmer of hope in the legislature that you some way will recognize that something needs to be done. And that's where we're putting our apples rather than going to the waivers. So the reason you're not seeing a list of waivers is we just, I think, ethically and professionally feel, why are we doing this? You know, why do we have to do this? Our mayors and councils are very capable of determining our salaries, and the residents and the chamber members who all think this is absolutely ridiculous will either support them or not support them, and that's where it ought to occur. So end of my comments. So.
And I know we're going to hear some more about recruitment, at least from Mr. Breemeyer, in a moment, but Senator Gaither wanted to say something, then Mayor, did you? Mm-hmm. Sorry. Senator Gaither.
Madam Chair, thank you. Members, one of the issues I struggle with, and I think the committee addressed this early on with the commissioner, is there a relationship between the governor's role as the chief executive officer of the state and local units of government in the public sector? We talk about public service, it's not the private sector, but yet we have comparisons to those free market conditions that apply to recruitment and retention. If you take that same type of model, and it's dangerous to do so, but you've got a scope of control issue that we talk about. Different cities have larger budgets, larger numbers of employees, larger salaries and larger compensation structures as a scope of control issue. And for me, the governor has a scope of control issue as well. We talked about a $30 billion budget and the associated trappings of the office. So what I struggle with is if there is, in fact, a relationship, and I think that anecdotally there certainly appears to be one, that the cap itself presents a unique set of challenges because it's an artificial limiter on that. You know, one conversation I respectfully utter in my own mind, and I'm somewhat reluctant to bring it forward, but if there was a relationship, maybe the relationship should be an inverse relationship. Maybe the governor should be a percentage, 120% of the highest local unit of government's compensation, if there is, in fact, a relationship between the two.
There
and,
you go.
And drive the process in action that way. Perhaps governor's compensation should include the variables of housing allowance and transportation charges and et cetera, et cetera. Although I think the IRS would probably comment whether they're a taxable event or not at a different matter. But I struggle with that internally in that if the cap is an encumberment to attract and retain people, if it is an encumberment upon a free market enterprise and a free market condition, and we declare it to be so, then the question I have rhetorically, and I'd like to kind of toss this back to the members of local government units, if there were no cap, what would be the proper salary structure for some of these folks? Are we within 5%? Are we within 25%? What is the market in a situation sans this particular limitation?
Mr. Bremeyer, did you want to respond to
that? Well, I think that, I know it's not my turn yet.
Yep, no.
That has never stopped me before.
Yes, you did. You did raise your hand.
People know.
Segue.
I think your argument is precisely the argument. There is no relationship between the qualifications to be governor and the qualifications required to be a city manager. And that's not a reflection on the current governor or past governors, but if you look at the current or past governors, what were the requirements? They had to be a resident of the state. I don't know if there's any, maybe there's more than that I'm missing, but I think that's really it. And in past governors, they didn't even have to work for state government. We're doing a search for the city of Hopkins right now for a city manager. You have to have a BA at a minimum, master's degree preferred, 10 years experience. You got to know all about tax increment finance. You got to know all about bond issues. You have to know how to read a pro forma statement for a redevelopment of a Main Street project in downtown Hopkins. You have to work with the county on improving Excelsior Boulevard. You have to look at all kinds of housing options. And you got to bring that to the table because these councils will tell you, look, Bremeyer, we're not going to have this be a learning experience on somebody's first job. They better come in with a bag of tools that they know what they're talking about. When you compare that to the governor, you really can't make an argument. I really don't appreciate the commissioner's position, the position he has put in. Quite frankly, I don't envy you trying to have to argue for this because it's pretty hard to do. You tried to tie it to local government aid and you tried to tie it to union negotiations, both arguments which were challenged and rightfully so. There is no argument for it. And if you look at the market data, which I happen to have because I happen to just get off the St. Louis Park City Council. And prior to that, I was a city manager, but that's another story. The market data that we tried to get a waiver for our city manager, who has since left for a salary on the East Coast at about $40,000 more than we were paying him. The ICMA market data from 2003 says the 50th percentile, that's the Q2, is about 100, for 03 was about 120, so calculate another 3 or 4%. What is that, 128, 130? If you look at the upper Midwest for 203, the percentile was about 127. That's the Q3 percentile, not the top, just kind of in the middle. And if you add 3 or 4% to that, whatever that number is for 2004. So what dictates those salaries are two things, the market and what city councils and mayors decide they want to pay. Now, does that affect recruitment and retention? Are we able to fill these positions? As Tom says, absolutely we can fill them. Are we getting the best and the brightest? I'm not sure. I can tell you this. In the recruiting business, when we make calls outside of the state of Minnesota for any position, and it's not just city administrators, it's that department head position where the compression is right up against the manager's salary, you're the state with the salary cap. No, thank you. And we're getting more and more of it, and in my position, too much of it, but the clients we work for. Now, does it affect Melrose, Minnesota, where we're currently doing a search where the salary cap isn't even a factor? Only in the sense that you're the state with the salary cap, and I'm not sure I want to go to work there. It does have an impact.
Senator Gaither, and then we're going to let Mr. Bremeyer.
Well, I think that was probably what I was going to say.
I wondered. It's
I do have a couple arguments here.
Okay.
I was going to.
Well, good, and we'll let you present that right in a moment. Senator Gaither wanted to say something, then Mayor Breed, and then.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As a follow-up to that, so I get the notion that there's qualifications, minimum standards, requirements to be in the game, to be considered.
Oh, absolutely.
Get that, but. Is it not then, did I not also understand that part of the other elements of the compensation and the duties and responsibilities for the job are issues like scope of control, are issues of size and depth of organization, so that while I get your notion that the governor has to fog a mirror and be here for 60 days, I get that part of it. But are you not then also saying, on the other hand, that there are, for city managers and the like, variables that are associated with their compensation and directly related to scope of control issues as well?
Yes, right.
So
right.
There is some overlap between...
There is. I mean, I understand the argument that the governor is the CEO of the state, and that's a good argument, and there's a broad span of control there, and plus you got the politics to deal with all the time, which I think makes it a very difficult job. And then there's all kinds of other comments I can make about governors, but I don't think this is the place to do that.
But when you look at what councils want, the hiring authorities want in city managers, this isn't a job you can just walk into. You don't just get elected and walk into it. Governors succeed, as we know, by their appointments. Whoever they appoint to those commissioner roles and those cabinet roles and deputy commissioner roles, that's what makes governors look good. Some of them do a good job at it, and some of them don't do such a good job at it. Managers, though, and governors are there for 4 years, guaranteed contract for 4 years. Managers can come in, and two council members change out of five, and their job is on the line. So is that a dangerous position? Is that a good argument? I'm not sure it is, because that's what the nature of the business, that's what you bought into. But those minimum, just the very minimum qualifications, you can't even make that argument about being a governor. I mean, and that's not a comment on the quality of the governors that we had. It's just the quality that there's just simply no comparison. And I remember when the law was passed, way back in the mid-'80s, I think. Because I think I was, or late-'80s, was that when it was passed? Do you remember?
Early-'90s. Well, it's had two versions.
Yeah, but the earliest version...
It was in the late 70s.
I think somewhere in that range, and they talked about the cap, and it was just somebody's idea. And at the time, it seemed fairly harmless because the governor's salary was pretty substantial then, I think, and nobody was even getting close to it. But I do remember coming over here with Mayor Phyllis McQuaid at the time, who also served in the legislature for a while, saying this just doesn't make any sense. There is no relationship. And some representative got up and said, you should be thankful to have a job in the public service and therefore work for almost anything. That was the attitude that was taken. And I don't think that's the attitude taken today. I don't get that impression. But you can't make the argument that there's any relationship between what a governor should make or a legislator should make or a city manager should make or what a council member should be paid. That's the local jurisdiction part of it. And if local governments get too out of control, we can do levy limits. We have all kinds of ways of controlling local governments. And for a while, it was LGA. I was on the council when I said I think the state bailed out on us when it came to LGA. But that's another argument also. But local governments survived it. They're very creative. They're very resourceful. And he's the one that's going to get the call if somebody thinks his city administrator's making too much money. Don't worry. He'll get it, and he'll get it big time. And that dictates how those salaries and the market. You got to look at the market. The market, we're trying to do some MIS director positions. In spite of the collapse of the bubble of 2001, they're still very difficult to find for this state because of the salary cap. We just did one for the city of Minneapolis in their business information systems. Excellent candidate from the East Coast. Salary cap was, she's not coming. Ended up hiring somebody local. Is that person competent? I think so. Did they get the best and the brightest? Well, it remains to be seen. And it's the compression issue that you really, let's say these guys are getting paid enough. I don't know. I don't think they are. But we made an argument for Charlie when I was on the council. But it's his finance director that he's trying to recruit or his police chief that he's trying to recruit. And they look at that and say, why would I possibly leave Des Moines or whatever, Mason City or someplace in Wisconsin and come work in the state where there's a salary cap? And Tom's right. That's the difficult part in recruiting. Is it evident? Is there data for it? No. You don't have data for that. There's no way you'd have data for that. No way you should have. But these guys do. I mean, they talk. It's the biggest gossip rumor mill in the state among city managers. I mean, they talk all the time. So they know what's going on around the state.
Mayor.
Madam Chair, thank you. Commissioner. I didn't get one of my name tags filled out. I'm Mayor Ardell Brady from Rochester, and my colleagues have basically said it all, but I did want to just underscore there is definite risk of losing some of our top people. In Rochester, on this sheet that we have, I think it's five on there, four that are already at the cap or above, and of the top six, we are at definite risk of losing four of them. I've talked to all of them, and they all have their resumes out looking for places. We not only lose this great talent for the city, but we lose it for the state as well, because They're not looking within the state. They're going to go elsewhere. So the cost to replace these people is probably greater than the couple thousand dollars we could pay them a year more, and certainly to recruit and the time it takes, all of that. The LGA cuts were there. We've experienced close to 50% with kind of the message that says, you know, you can, it's your own money, you take care of things in your own city, and now we can't do that. And I'd take the responsibility, and you're right, we would get the calls. We're the ones who get the calls. It's not for me. I get $30,000 a year, and I'm elected, so I'm not in this anyway. But I would just, again, underscore what's already been said, whether we do some other percentage, turn the table and say the governor is what percent of the highest official. I don't know, but it doesn't seem reasonable the way it's running right now.
Mayor Breedy, isn't Rochester one of the more or most livable
cities? We are.
And I assume that
almost
some
every
of
year.
These folks had something to do with that as well as the
course,
fine people you
of
have.
Of course, and approaching 100,000 population, too. So it's there again, some of the comparing apples and apples, and with full respect to the much smaller cities, but when you put them all in the same plane for a salary, it doesn't seem reasonable.
Representative Haas,
and then. This is a very interesting discussion because I've been on both sides. Because I hired two city administrators when I was mayor and went through the process, and what we wanted as a council and where we were going in the direction of the city and things like that. At the same time, our city right now, a number of the people who are in leadership roles, including the city administrator, started out in the Parks Department, worked his way up. You know, we gave him opportunity to learn and to succeed by his own initiative, and now he's our city administrator. And I think that's one of the points I think, you know, I hear you want to retain what you have, but, you know, part of business and being a good manager is grooming the people underneath you to succeed and come up and to take over. You know, and that's where you, you know, as a manager, and that's what we basically are as a city council or a legislature, as managers, and we need to groom these people and give them the opportunity to move forward. You know, when we interviewed city administrators, we asked them point blank, how long do you think you'll be here? And most of them said 5 years. So it's an evolving process you go through, because you know they look for other opportunities and they do send out resumes and things like that, but they're advancing in their career also. But it also provides opportunity for people under them who are getting out of school and who are getting the jobs. It creates opportunity for them, and we're tapping new ideas, new resources to come in and to manage our cities. You know, we don't want to get caught in a stalemate where it's the same old thing and we're just going to keep them there. You need to, and I know in our city in particular, we just found we needed new ideas and new thoughts. But yet at the same time, we worked with internally to promote people who were really doing a good job. And I think that's important. One of the things, we could lose people, other states, and Mr. Brinmeyer brought it up, that they lost a fellow to the East Coast for 40,000 more years. But look at the cost of living out there. He probably needed that, or she, that $40,000 a year to compensate them to go out there because of the cost of living. Now, at the same point, you were trying to hire that person from the East Coast to come here, and they're making $40,000 more than what we can pay them. Are we going to raise their salary $40,000 to bring them out here and then have a cost of living that's lower than what it is? It's no different than the rural area. The cost of living in the rural area is less than the metro area. So there's geographic differences that I think you got to look at, and you know, and that, those are all things we got to take into consideration. And yes, you know, you can levy for more. You know, legislature can put levy limits, but that gets negative because that gets thrown back against the legislature. Because I hear from my city council people, and hear from citizens, because that gets more press. That we're going to impose levy limits, so then it's said that, you know, we got to cut fire and police and all this stuff because we got levy limits or we're losing, you know, reducing the LGA, than to look at salary and say, well, we're still increasing salaries, but we're going to cut these positions. You know, we as a state, if you notice, and people have been in this room for, you know, through the course of last year, it's tough to sit down at a bargaining table and go for no increase in pay. It is tough, but those are decisions that we had to make because we only had so much money available. And maybe we're going to lose a few people because of that. You know, and I hope not, but our goal was to keep everybody working and not have any layoffs. But yet, if somebody does leave because they're not getting a salary increase, that creates opportunity for somebody else to come in. So do we win, do we lose? You know, that's the question we have to ask ourselves.
Mr. Goodwin, and then I think we're going to let Mr. Permano.
I just have one more comment to make. I think he makes a good argument, though, about the geographical differences. I think that is something to take into account.
Mr. Goodwin.
Well, I was going to finish with this, but I can start with this. The geographical difference, one example would be Iowa. Iowa. We're always telling Iowa jokes. Well, the Iowegians are now paying more than we are. So maybe in the public sector down there, they're starting to tell Minnesota jokes. I don't know. But we're not talking about the East Coast and the West Coast here. There's a couple points I'd like to make, and we've all been talking about the governor's salary. Why don't we just say it? That's a political settlement, $120. Governor, if you're listening, you're grossly underpaid. You ought to make double what you're making. I don't know the governor. I knew him a little bit when he was on the Eagan City Council. I do know the chief of staff, Mr. McElroy, and I made this comment last time. One of the brightest guys I know, I think Mr. McElroy is grossly underpaid. But I don't think what you do is if you set a political salary and you understand it's set for entirely different reasons, you can't go against the marketplace as we have to work with it. I'd also like to back up my cohorts here. I'm a city council member. I have no problem sitting on the city council floor taking a vote and saying our city manager or administrator should make X amount of money. I have no problem with that. If I don't have a problem with it, I don't quite understand why you have a problem with it. Some of the things that happen, the crazy stuff you get into, we may not know all what public servants or public administrators make, but believe me, the public administrators know. We have a situation right now. This is anecdotal. I don't have the numbers, but I'm told that in our school district 196, because there's no cap, not only does the superintendent and the deputy superintendent make more than our city manager, but they're starting to get a number of department heads. I don't have a problem with the superintendent of schools of District 196 making a lot more than the city manager of Apple Valley. I don't have a problem with the deputy superintendent of schools. But do I have a problem with the purchasing director, the human resource director, the people that have just one basic part of the pie making more? You bet I do. And if my anecdotal information is correct, and this is anecdotal, if you start to get five or six or seven people from a school district where there's no cap making more than your chief administrator, that kind of thing isn't good for morale. And that's the kind of thing that gets out into the other states. Couple other points. I'm very active in our chamber, which we are business people. I'm very active in our Rotary Club. It's not an issue with them. I don't hear from the Rotary Club. Matter of fact, I had one friend in a Rotary Club the other day tell me, geez, I read in the paper what your administrator makes, and I wouldn't work for you guys for that. I hope he was half serious and half joking. But for people in the metropolitan area, these kind of salaries are just not the issue that they may be in other places. And another thing, too, and I just want to go back to the example of governors and why they're different. If you leave a city administrator's position in Minnesota, I know our city administrator has been recruited very strongly. He loves Minnesota, but he's been frozen in his salary, I believe, for 2 or 3 years. The folks that know our administrator know he could go about anywhere. We hate to lose him. But where does an administrator go when he leaves? He doesn't hit the jackpot. Usually he goes to an administrator's job elsewhere. That's their track. Where do governors go when they leave? Just the other day in the paper, I read an article about the average salary of board of directors of large corporations. I know Governor Carlson, I believe, is on a board or two. $176,000 a year. We had a governor that just left, the last governor that left, from what I read in the paper, he took a job for $2 million bucks for a TV show that never even worked out. I think we all have to face facts. When governors leave, they have opportunities to go elsewhere. We're not talking about a career track where a guy says, well, as a governor of Minnesota, I think I'll go be the governor of California. That's a bigger state.
But it's possible.
Well, you never know. Could become president.
Take more money, it might be worth
it. My point is, and I appreciate the experience of the city council, Representative Haas, but I can sit up there and take that vote. My fellow council members can take that vote. And the people that I deal with in the business community in Apple Valley, and the people that I know and live in the community, they're saying that's your job. And if I suffer politically for it, too bad for me. Then I suffer politically. And if people don't like the salary that I'm paying or vote to pay the city administrator, by God, they'll call me. And that's their, and that's their duty, and I should listen to them. But the apples and oranges things of the governor is just it's really causing trouble. Anecdotally, Jim will tell you, I mean, not just anecdotally, but it's starting to have a real impact on the market, and there's just no doubt about it in my mind. Thank you.
Mr. Brimmer, just a moment, because I want you to do your presentation and
I've kind of done
comment
it,
on things.
But I do have another comment.
I did want to ask the commissioner, is it possible to quantify the compensation to the governor? Obviously, there are some things that can't be. You can't apply a number to. But do we have that any place? Do we know? And I'm not sure that it's your job, but do we know the value of the benefits that a governor, any governor, receives? Is it possible? Do you think we could?
Well, Madam Chairman, Ms. Pettis has informed me that there have been previous attempts to try to quantify that, not for this governor, but for previous administrations. Governor's going to Duluth tomorrow morning, and he's got to get there fast. He's got to get back fast. So there's flight transportation. Is that a part of compensation? It's for the business. It's for the job.
Probably not, I'd say, right on the face of it.
But a car is provided. We probably can put value on that. The governor's residence, what portion of that is determined condition of the job, mm-hmm. as far as the head of the state responsibilities and as a residence. The governor doesn't reside there every day.
Right.
Some governors didn't want to reside there at all. So do you value that for that governor? There have been some previous attempts at trying to value these issues relative to what would be called compensation. We have not spent time on that. It does spark one question in some of Mr. Goodwin's, if I may, Madam Chairman. I don't mean to interrupt anybody other's presentation, but I think what I was trying to talk about in the earlier presentation is that the Department of Employee Relations feels a strategic relationship to the way we deal with this salary cap. So perhaps, you heard numbers earlier on some settlements that have been achieved here and signed contracts that have numbers in the realm of 1.10 for a base increase, for biennial increases of 3.69. These are dramatic numbers, and I certainly this committee recognizes that in very difficult budget times. So in a strategic sense, for the Department of Employee Relations to say we're changing the way we're viewing, and even though we think we're doing this as professionally as we possibly can in engaging the retention and recruitment problems of waiver applications brought to us, maybe what I'm saying is that maybe the place of it being done is wrong. There was an idea floated several years ago about pay equity being done at the state auditor's office. Maybe this doesn't solve anybody's problem. Maybe this complicates people's problem. But in a strategic sense, this department has to care about its that relationship to the other part of our work. And I'm doesn't say that statutorily. Saying that's the way this world works. So it was just one idea that
no,
had,
I appreciate
had
your
sparked some
sharing that with us.
Conversation about perhaps the way that the waivers would be looked at.
Thank you. Mr. Brimmer.
Well, I
let you have the floor here. You can comment on
it. I'm gonna take off my headhunter hat and wear my former city council hat and maybe address an issue that you brought up earlier. When I was on the city council and tough decisions would come up, one of my criteria for making a decision would be, can I explain this tomorrow morning to the 8th grade civics class? Very simple. If I can explain this decision and justify it, then it's probably a good idea. You take back to Senator Gaither's question, it'd be hard to explain to an 8th grade civics class what relationship there is between a governor's salary or any other state official's salary and a city manager or school superintendent's salary. It would really be tough to do. And so when we think about, okay, we're stuck with it, and I appreciate the commissioner's dilemma. I mean, I bet you talk about this frequently, like, why in the hell do we have to do this? Why can't some other commissioner do this? I don't blame you for feeling that way. I would if I were in your spot, because you really are between a rock and a hard place, and I appreciate that. But if you look at the waivers that have been requested, they're all fairly large organizations. That's the second to the last page, I'm guessing here, from 1997 through 2004. I don't know if that's all of them. They're large organizations, and you asked earlier, Madam Chair, about is there some way to tweak this? And is there some way to explain it to the 8th grade civics class? And maybe there is. Maybe what we ought to be doing is looking at salary caps. If we have to have a salary cap politically, then maybe we ought to look at size of organization, size being defined, I don't know, population, employees, budget. I suppose you could have 8 or 10 different criteria. Or you might say, okay, for that size of organization, the salary range ought to be no more than X. And then the next size of organization, the salary range ought to be X. And then when you get to the Melroses that we're working on, or Lake City, which are the smaller, greater Minnesota communities, maybe that range is something else. And take the governor's salary, the political governor's salary, because that's what it is, and that can be set anywhere. Just take that out of the equation. But still the legislature then can argue this is the salary cap, and if Doer has to enforce it or regulate it or moderate it or watch it, at least they've got some range to work with. And you can explain to you, I mean, it's easier for you to come to a committee like this and say, how come this person's salary is above the range we established back in 2004? There might be a reason for that waiver, but the waiver request should be absolutely minimal. Does that make too much sense?
I understood it.
and that in a piecemeal fashion was going to be what I was going to say today, I guess.
Okay. Did you want to elaborate any more?
I think I have my reasons here. I've said those. The market really dictates. This idea of ranges just came up after you asked your question, and I heard the argument, well, if you had a $40 million corporation and 200 and some employees, what would the private sector pay for that? Well, should we pay what the private sector pays? I'm not making that argument.
Yeah.
Because the private sector has different sets of rules for compensation. I own my own business. I can bonus myself whenever I want. That hasn't happened much in the last couple of years, but I'm allowed to do that. The public sector has to operate under a different set of rules, and I understand that and appreciate that. There has to be that accountability issue. Nobody argues with that. And the accountability issue should stay there, but it ought to have some rationale on how it got there. And it doesn't have that now. But that's what all of you have said that. It doesn't have that now. Even the commissioner's in that spot where he has to say, here's my rationale for it, and I appreciate his predicament, but it would not meet the 8th grade civics class test.
Okay. Representative Haas, did you want to?
Yeah, just a comment. I think Mr. Vermeier might have touched on something that might be something to look at, is considering budget size and city size in different categories. And with caps might be, you know, more justifiable and more comfortable for everybody to deal with and provide yet some flexibility in this. But I think, you know, what I think if we need to do is look at
how this would,
you know, break out and some of the recommendations, and then maybe bring it back before the committee, and maybe the subcommittee could put some numbers together that for us to consider at our next meeting. But that might be a potential way to go that would eliminate, you know, it addresses
both concerns.
We still have caps, that we would deal with, but there would be more of a rational way to look at those caps.
Representative Haas, do you see taking the governor's salary out of the equation, perhaps?
Potentially, that might be a way to do it. You know, if we can come up with a formula within a grid or whatever that we could apply, and we'd be comfortable that there would be caps and that, but then they would be able to have their hands untied somewhat to attract the people they need. And yet, you know, the salaries aren't going to get out of control either. You know, so, but I think
it's something
for us. The next step is to take a look at a grid or have them develop some kind of grid and then apply it and see how it will work. And then, you know, have our discussion as a group and then decide where we want to go from there, and look at other information, you know, or tweak it in some way in order to that, you know, that all sides could agree with.
Any other? I think it's been a very productive conversation, actually, discussion. And I appreciate everybody's, you know, forthrightness. And I really appreciate, Commissioner, you taking the time to share your perspective, and I don't think it's easy, and I certainly see the why you wouldn't want to have to deal with this, because it's a very frustrating topic for legislators. Certainly it's frustrating for local government folks, and trying to justify it is tough, and so, or to, you know, have an intellectual response to why we do this. You know, I understand the emotional and or political reason why we did it, but that's I think we may be coming up, we may have come up with some, at least a realization that there might be something we can do. That's I'm not sure where we'll end with that, because I think that it's fair to say that politically we're not going to remove the salary cap. I mean, if nothing else happens, I don't think we're going to, you know, be doing that. It just doesn't seem like that's politically possible to do. And so we may be able to come at it from a different angle, and that's more angles.
Madam Chair, in order to have it go in an orderly fashion, we may want to look at incremental implementation to mm-hmm. get to those new caps, rather than setting new caps and then opening it up, but do something where it's incrementally using the kingdoms and get the people where we feel they need to go, but yet in an orderly fashion.
I hope members had an opportunity to look at some information that Mr. Hubinger and his office have prepared as well, just kind of the initial findings from the data. And the data is these two sheets. Well, actually, there's more. And the stapled. So there's all this data, these lists of positions and lists of municipalities, and then kind of the findings are kind of the summary of that data. Interesting things. I think we need to decide here what it is we want, what kind of data we want, we're now looking for. What kind of, if we're looking at categories, if we're looking at ranges, or is that what, you know?
Well, Madam Chair, I think what I would suggest is the subcommittee get back together and kind of make a couple recommendations. You know, and you have the numbers, and you can start playing around with the numbers on a grid, how it works, and then come up with a couple variations, and I think bring it back to this group and let us take a look at it.
Representative Haas, are you talking to the local government folks and
the work group that we have together?
Yes.
Let them sit down and
kind of hash it over.
Well, we're part of that.
I know, but
okay.
But not everybody's here, and I think we need to do it at a full subcommittee hearing when we get together. But I
think the group needs to,
you know, the cities and the counties need to put together some numbers and some example grids, and maybe they can work with Commissioner Ludeman and his staff to do that, and then bring that back at a couple examples for us to look at.
Any comments or questions? I really appreciate everybody's participation today. It's very, I think, a productive conversation. Any other questions or concerns members have? I think we will be meeting again to be determined. Probably not before the election. So it should be good news to our House counterparts and any who are up for re-election. Anybody, any of our local, are you, Mr. Goodwin? So.
I actually had somebody file against me this year, which.
Uh-oh.
I don't know how I let that happen.
Madam Chair, if,
yes.
I, if I may. Just,
I'm Commissioner.
You know, I signed on to be the Doer Commissioner, not the Dower Commissioner.
Did you say Dower?
No.
Oh,
I'm just saying that much of the conversation that we often have is about depression and keeping salaries low. Obviously, we share with every local government here an opportunity. We desire to be the best employees, next best employer. And so we want to make sure we're about market compensation. We understand all that, and we have a desire as a state government, as well as every other local government, I think, and probably every employer in the state of Minnesota, to be that kind of an employer. But we have to do it in the realm of the world and economics and budgets.
Yeah, and I respect your honesty with us about that. I do. The working group, I think, and I never really officially called us to order. We just got together and started working. Yeah. So we'll stop working for right now. And then, Mr. Hubinger, again, because we did not have a quorum because a member was unable to get here, we needed 6 of the 10. The contracts can go forward because we've considered them. They can go forward unless we were to meet and reject them. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And then, Madam Chair,
Representative Haas.
Then in January, we will then take up the final approval of those, but the contracts will go into effect in 30 days.
Madam Chair, Representative House, that's correct.
Okay, that's good.
Did you see that? Yes. So, any other business then of the subcommittee? Don't worry about moving or leaving. Any others? I want to thank everybody for being here. Appreciate it very much, and thank you to the members of the subcommittee. With that, the meeting will be adjourned. I think so. That was a good conversation.
Keith Carlson.
Hi, Keith. Possibly want to get some of us together to talk about working on this grid.
Sure. Absolutely.